Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And when you go back and listen to Siri on the iPhone 4S, you'll hear that she talks a bit like this. She doesn't have a flow to her voice because that required a little bit more technological advancement.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music. Let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study they move, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Silent Giants Podcast, a podcast that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. To keep up with the latest on the podcast, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Silent Giants Podcast. To keep up with the latest with me, hit me up on Instagram at Corey Cambridge. Our special guest this episode is Susan Bennett, the silent giant behind the iconic voice of Siri. Susan is a super talented voiceover actor who has lended her voice to brands like Coca-Cola, IBM, Papa John's, McDonald's, AT&T, Wendy's, Goodyear, Ford, and many others. But of course, we most notably recognize her as Apple's iconic voice of Siri. In this episode, we learn more about Susan, how her career in music led her to a career as a voiceover actor. And of course, we learn the story of how she became the voice of Siri. So, without further ado, allow me to introduce you to the voiceover actor, musician, my friend, the silent giant, Susan Bennett. Yo, what's up, Susan? How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Oh, man, you know, I can't complain. Under the circumstances that the world is under right now, I can't complain. Live in Los Angeles. Living by the beach.
Oh, all right.
Hanging out with my dog. Life is good.
Good, good. My son lives in Santa Monica.
Oh, well, we're like neighbors. I'm in Venice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I might see him around in the streets.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned you said you're in Atlanta, right?
Yeah.
How's everything in Atlanta right now?
Well, my husband and I have been really good about isolating, so we don't really see too much. You know, we go to the grocery store and Target and come back home. So, you know, it's like every other place in the U.S. I think you've got plenty of people that are trying to be helpful and wearing masks and being socially distant. And then you've got the others.
Right. You know, I'm not a part of the others.
That's right. We don't need to get into that.
But I do the double mask, though. I do the double mask.
Oh, okay.
You know, I make it trendy. I get like my patterns on my mask and everything.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Oh, yeah. For sure. it's such an honor to have you on the podcast. And I start the interviews out the same way every time. Because, Susan, I find that when I've had the pleasure of interviewing a lot of great people and people who've achieved a lot of great things in their life. And I think before I got into this world of meeting such amazing people, I kind of thought of success like, oh, it's like picked off of a tree. It's like, you know, it's some random selection type of thing. And then I realized there's a recipe behind it. And I find that two things really determine and mainly determine a person's success, which is what their parents do and who their parents are and also where they're from. So tell me about your hometown and where you're from and how that shaped you.
Well, I was born in Vermont, but I lived there a very short time. I lived all over New England, outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and then outside of Providence, Rhode Island. But the part that I really consider that I know best and relate to the most is my junior high and high school years in Clinton, New York. And Clinton, New York is a very, very tiny town, but Hamilton College is there. So it's kind of a cool little place. And I was fortunate that my parents moved there because I had a very, very thick New England accent. And when I got to Clinton, New York, fortunately, they have a much more neutral accent. And so I was able to lose my thick New England accent, because if I had kept it, I would not have been a voice actor, first of all, and certainly not the voice of Siri. So I am very, very grateful to Clinton for helping me get rid of my accent. As far as my parents are concerned, they had me fairly late in life, and they were people that really had to live through a lot of hardships. They lived through the flu pandemic of 1918. They lived through two world wars. They lived through a major depression. And then they lived through the 1960s hippie years with me. And so, you know, they were very pretty conservative, just sort of, you know, middle-class people that just, you know, were good people, but not very ambitious and very cautious people. So I think that I got some sort of not inspiring lessons from them as a person who was a natural performer. And so, you know, because their thing was, they were very cautious people. And their I think my mom's mantra was, don't impose, which is, you know, really not a very good lesson for a person who's trying to, you know, get out there and express himself or herself. So, but they were very good people. They were very supportive. And they did great considering what they were living through.
How does having, you know, having older parents shape you?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I think probably they weren't as active as other parents, you know, and of course they weren't that old when they had me. They were like 36 or something, but for that generation, that was really old. I mean, in that generation, people got married right out of high school and college and then had kids right away and stuff. So they were sort of unique in that way. And they were just naturally, you know, pretty conservative people in general. But they gave me a lot of opportunities. And once they found out that I was musical, at the age of 4 years old, I was playing a little toy piano. I was playing melodies by ear. And neither of my parents is a musical person. And so the next door neighbor heard me out on the porch playing. He called my parents and said, I think you have a musical child. I'm getting ready to move and I want her to have my piano.
Wow.
So thank you, Mr. Tegner. Yes, he gave me his upright piano. So I was able to take piano lessons and ultimately became a musician. So,
you know, I would say as I grow older, I'm growing more spiritual. And I started realizing, like, for me, I started viewing angels as not these, like, you know, things that like float around, you know,
yeah,
but like things or people that come into your life and drop things there that change the course of your life.
Right. Yeah. And it's amazing when you look back on it. You know, at my age, I look back, so many things that happened to me that really directed my life. So many of them seem to be kind of serendipitous, you know, it's not planned. And it was just, and Siri is one of those things.
Yeah. I know you mentioned about the piano. What was it like, you know, growing up playing music? Did you know instantly when you started playing music that you wanted to be a musician professionally?
Well, you know, back in those days, I didn't think that I could be a musician and actually make a living at it. So I hadn't entertained that thought, really. You know, I went to college and I really basically didn't know what I wanted to do. I wasn't one of those lucky people that said, oh, I'm going to be a doctor, you know, and started going to school for those. I didn't have any specific goal. And so I just figured, well, I guess I'll teach, you know, that was the thing to fall back on. And so when I was in college, though, I had the opportunity to sing in a band and actually start making money, you know, working with a band. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do this. I did get married early, right out of college, and then my husband and I moved to Atlanta, and I just started doing all kinds of work in Atlanta, singing in restaurants and clubs, and started doing a lot of studio work, singing jingles and background vocals for people, and that is what ultimately led to my voiceover career, which led to Siri.
I want to go back just a second and touch on, like, obviously, when I talk to Susan Bennett today, I'm talking to a fully evolved human being. But who were you as a kid? Like, what was your personality like, and who were you back then?
Well, I don't know if you think much of astrology, but I have four planets in Leo, and two of them, one the sun sign and one the rising sign. So
what's all that mean?
Well, Leos are probably known for being pretty strong and aggressive and sort of bossy and, you know, just kind of. So I'm very grateful for my Libra moon. But when I was a little kid, I was very energetic and I was very, you know, just running all over the place. And then I totally changed personality because this is an interesting and talk about something that happened that directed my life. I mean, this thing totally changed my personality. My parents lived in Massachusetts during the McCarthy era when they were spying on people because they thought they were communists. Well, the FBI came into our house and was there for several weeks spying on our neighbor. Mm. And so that just, I think it totally freaked me out. I couldn't stand having people in the house that weren't invited, really. And so I think that really had an effect on my personality for many years. And it took me a while before I came back out and started to be more gregarious. You know, really that experience really kind of freaked me out.
Because, you know, going back to the point I was making earlier about, I really do believe that greatness is not by accident, that it really is a recipe. Were there people that, who were your early like role models or people that you grew up being like, man, I want to be like them, or they were inspirational to you?
You know, it's funny. I enjoyed different people, but I didn't necessarily look at them as role models. I had some teachers, of course, that I respected a lot. And, you know, it's really hard to say. Gosh, that's a very good question. And I don't really have a specific answer for you. I think that more it was an environmental thing for me. I had the opportunity to go to a very good college and I had the opportunity to, at that time, they were changing all of their different curricula, because during that time, during the 60s, there everything was just really changing a lot. You know, my first year of college, you know, we had to sit down at a table and, you know, they rang a little bell and you had to sit next to someone that you didn't know so that you would learn your social skills. And we went from that my freshman year to co-ed dorms my senior year. So
party.
You know, four really dramatically changing years, you know. So they're from, you know, freshman year to senior year was an amazing change. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me, having come from a very, very small town, to meet other people from all over the country and from different walks of life, people from different countries and that sort of thing, because I've been pretty sheltered in that way.
But what about your musical influences?
My musical influences, oh, well, you know, there are the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. When I was younger, I was a huge Barbara Streisand fan and I was, you know, listened to all her albums. But throughout the years, you know, and I took classical piano lessons, so, you know, I learned some classical pieces. And the first band that I was in was sort of a jazz rock fusion band. So that was a lot of fun. But I think it, you know, as it evolved, I really became a lot more interested in, well, especially since my husband now is that he's really a fabulous blues and rhythm and blues player and rock and roll. And so I'm sure I was greatly influenced by him, but I've always loved bands more than just, you know, individual singers. So it's always bands that I like.
And so I know you mentioned that you were in a band in college. And how was your musical career going? I guess you were pursuing that down in Atlanta. What was that experience like?
Oh, well, in college, I didn't go to college in Atlanta, but I started to sing with a band in college. And then when I moved to Atlanta and I started to do, you know, I had gone to school with these people that were just really, you know, virtuosos, you know, musically. And so I didn't really think that I was good enough to play out in public. And then when I came down here and I would go out to different places and go, oh, well, I can do that. So I started to sing and play in clubs and restaurants and got involved in doing some studio work. And that was wonderful. I met some wonderful people and I still have friends from meeting those people back in the early 70s and working with them during that time.
Yeah, because, I mean, we obviously know Atlanta today as being such a music mecca.
But, oh, yeah.
But at the time, it wasn't that, you know? So, like, what was the music scene like back then?
Well, I think there was a lot, you know, it had a lot to do with what music was kind of a big deal at the time. And so there were lots of, you know, restaurants and places where they had little jazz trios and things like that. And then there would be other places that had, you know, rock bands and things like that. And I ended up having a band with my husband for close to 25 years. We did a lot of private parties and things like that. So we kind of ran the gamut of the type of things that we performed. So it was all, you know, pretty diverse and a lot of fun.
So tell me, you know, well, one thing is I always joke around with podcasting that, you know, no one grew up wanting to be a podcaster. Right. It wasn't on my generation's radar of things to be. But how did you make the transition over from music to doing voiceovers?
Well, it was sort of accidental. As I said, I had been doing a lot of jingle singing at different studios. And this one studio that was really, really big deal for many, many years, it just closed like 3 years ago or so, I guess, Doppler Studios. So I did a lot of work for them. And one day I'd been singing with a group for some commercial, and I wish I could remember what commercial it was, but the voice actor didn't show up to read the copy for the spot. So the studio owner said, "Susan, you don't have an accent. Come over here and read this copy." And so I went, "Oh, ding, 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 I can do this." And so I thought, well, here might be a whole new career, because, you know, when you're a musician, that's freelance. You're never guaranteed work. And so you're always, you know, scrambling around looking for stuff to do. So I thought, well, that would be a great thing to do. And so I got a voice coach and then a talent agent, and I've been doing voice work ever since.
And so when you first started doing voiceover work, did you realize, like, whoa, this is something I really like? Like, I like doing this.
Yes. Yeah, I really liked it. It came very easily to me. It was very instinctive. There are a lot of voiceover people that do come from music, because reading copy, I think that does require a sense of rhythm and a good ear, you know, to me. And so it was kind of a natural transformation. And the thing that was so cool is that I'd already joined, well, at the time it was AFTRA and SAG were separate unions. And now it's SAG-AFTRA. They joined a few years ago. But it was so cool because a lot of the commercial work that was done at the time was done through the union. And so you would get these incredible checks, and you'd get residual checks for some of the stuff that you had done. It was sort of like, oh, wow. Yeah. It's like, I guess I'm not going to play the piano at the, you know, at that little restaurant anymore. I think I'll just do this.
Yeah. Because, you know, I had the pleasure of interviewing this gentleman by the name of Vijay Clark Kent. And he talks about how, you know, he's a DJ, but he's A&R'd and he's big in the sneaker world, and he's kind of a jack of all trades. But he always says that everything I do as a DJ. And that allows me to be great at every other thing that I do, because my approach to it is as a DJ.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you feel like, because of your career as a musician and as an artist, that that approach has allowed you to be successful in the voiceover world? And if so, how?
As I said, I think that being a musician and having a good ear, and also as a musician, I think, you know, any kind of artist, whether it's, you know, someone in the visual arts or music or literature or anything like that, I think that artists tend to have a more open mind, more, you know, compassion and empathy for other people, and more, you know, sort of instinctive reactions to certain things. So I think that a lot of what I ended up doing in the voiceover field came to me instinctively. And a lot of that was because of just being able to hear the differences and things, which I attribute to being musical, you know, so.
I know you mentioned getting an agent, and that sounds so kind of easy, but it, when you say it, but it's something that like doesn't register as something to do right away. Like, oh, I'm gonna do voiceovers and let me get an agent. How'd you know to go about like that process of getting an agent?
Well, the process of getting into voiceover then is so different than it is now, because, you know, this was pre-technology. This was pre, you know, digital stuff, you know, and pre-personal computers and things like that. So the only way to get work was through an agent or to be, you know, to avail yourself to all the different studios that were in town. There was Doppler and Master Sound, RKM. And, you know, it was a pretty thriving community. I mean, you could actually, I mean, when I was a jingle singer, you could actually make a living doing that. You know, I would have several gigs like that a week, because that's, you know, at that time they were having original music done for commercials. You know, then we've been through a whole big thing now where they're using old rock songs for commercials, right? And, you know, and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a, you know, different trends in different decades, and you sort of have to keep up with all of that. But gosh, I think I digressed and forgot the original question.
You know what though, Susan, I always, as I grow older, I start to realize that life is made up of moments. And mm-hmm. there's so many days, but I don't know what I was doing like March 3rd of 1998. I have no idea. But I do remember like the big things, sad or happy moments in my life. They stick, right. they stick with me. In your professional career as a voiceover actor, what was your first, I call them, oh shit moments? When you go, oh. when you go, oh shit, this is awesome and this is fantastic.
Yeah. I think it was that very first day. That very first day when I had that, you know, when the studio owner said, Susan, come over here. And I just went, ooh, boing. And then when I was able to do it and they used it, you know, it was like, oh, this is great. Oh shit, it's exactly right. It's, you know, yeah. That was definitely a huge moment. I've been so fortunate. I've been doing a lot of interesting voiceover work, but also, you know, interesting music work. And I toured with Burt Bacharach and Roy Orbison.
Yeah.
And that was just, I mean, I look back on my life and I go, wow, I've done some cool stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So how many years, we now know you as the voice of Siri, but how many years had you been putting in that work? I think for young people, they just see the quick success of like the way Instagram is now and you can get things instantly. But, you know, I had a crazy moment when I got to interview this guy named Bruce Wedeen, who was Michael Jackson's engineer. And I realized like, yeah, he recorded Thriller. And I realized like, whoa. Oh, Bruce is
one of my absolute favorites of all time.
And you know what? Bruce, when I was in his house, I realized like, wow, this dude recorded Thriller when he was in his 50s. Like his greatest success came after putting in 30 years worth of work. How much time went into you being a voiceover actor until your big, big moment that we all know today as you being the voice of Siri?
Well, let's do the math. I started doing voiceovers probably in the mid 70s. So that's 75, 85, 95, 2005. So we've got like, then Siri came. So it's like close to 40 years.
Wow.
Close to 40 years. And the thing is that this is one of the things I talk about in my Siri speaker events that I do. I talk about the recordings. I talk about the voiceover business, but I talk about how it affected me and how I had to deal with it. And one of the things I talk about, because you're right, kids just, they're so used to things being instantaneous. And I always talk to them too about saying, you know, success isn't necessarily just having, you know, tons of money and being able to buy this and that and this and that. A lot of success has to, for me, success was being able to make a living doing what I love. And I've been so fortunate. Quick, let me knock wood.
Yeah.
I've been so fortunate to be able to do that. And to me, anything above that was just gravy, you know? And so I've been extremely fortunate.
So tell me, like, how did the Siri opportunity, you know, come about?
Well, I didn't realize it was an opportunity. There were four original Siri voices. The North American voice was me, and then there was an Australian, British, and I think the fourth one was French. And two of those people were males. The British guy, John Briggs, was Daniel. And then I'm not sure about the French guy, but we were the originals. And so we sort of, in a way, paid the price because it was the very first, in a way, it was like the very first public manifestation of AI. We were the first virtual assistants and we were sort of breaking ground. And because of that, we didn't really know what we had done. When we were doing the recordings, I did my initial recordings in 2005. And I know that the other people had the same experience because I talked to them. And we all thought that we were just doing some sort of generic phone messaging stuff. Now, we knew there was something a little different because the scripts were so crazy. The scripts were for IVR, which is interactive voice response. So every voice that you hear that is an informational type voice, like any virtual assistant, like Siri, Alexa, Cortana, Google, or any GPS voice, all of those voices came from these types of recordings. And the things that make them wacky are...
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All the phrases and sentences were created just for sound, not at all for meaning. They just wanted to get all of the sound combinations possible in the language. And so these sentences that I had to read sounded like, these are actual phrases that ultimately became part of Siri. Cow hoist in the tub hut today. Militia oi hallucinate. Bukra okra ooze. Fossa, ask fussy. You know, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And so you'd read hours of this stuff. And eventually, and the thing that made it tedious was not just the amount of time, but every phrase had to be read exactly alike. No change in pitch, no change in pacing, the same tone all the way throughout. And it was quite monotone because all of the sounds within the phrases had to be in the same level for the concatenation process. And what that means is that technicians and computers would go into the recordings, extract sounds, reform these sounds into new phrases and sentences, and these are what ended up on our devices as Siri and Alexa, et cetera, answers to our questions. So it's just an incredibly amazing process that I can't really get my mind around because I'm not very techie at all. But it was just a really incredible process. And when you go back and listen to Siri on the iPhone 4S, you'll hear that she talks a bit like this. She doesn't have a flow to her voice because that required a little bit more technological advancement, you know. So now the current Siri, and the voice, of course, was changed. So Siri is now a millennial, but it's a lot more flowing and it sounds a lot more human. And that's because of the advancement in technology.
Like who reached out? Did you know that it was for Apple or?
No.
Oh, not at all.
And I have never heard from Apple in any way, shape or form.
Wow. Wait, so yeah. Where did you record where was the session held?
I recorded it from home in my home studio. And I recorded it through a liaison company here in Atlanta to the biggest IVR company in the world, which is called Nuance. And I think Apple may have bought Nuance because they got all of their voices from Nuance. But it was one of those things where, you know, the subsequent voices, you probably will not ever find out who they are because they have non-disclosure agreements. The original four voices, we didn't have NDAs. And so we're allowed to advertise who we are. And so because of that, I was able to come up with a brand new career thanks to Siri and do speaker events and Siri appearances and things like that, which has been really, really fun. So,
wow. How did it come to be that you would find out that you were the voice of Siri?
Well, I got an email. Siri appeared on October 4th, 2011. And that very day, I got an email from a fellow voice actor who said, "Hey, we're playing around with this new iPhone app. Isn't this you?" And I went, "What?" And so I went on the Apple site and listened and I went, "Oh my God." Because something like that, and you don't know about it, it's like, well, usually it's something of this big a deal, you'd be auditioning for weeks, you know. And I guess what I can say is that in the digital age, all of us voice actors are auditioning all the time, whether we know it or not. And so my voice apparently was chosen out of some big IVR bank of voices. I don't know who chose it. I don't know when they chose it. I don't know anything about it. And Apple has not really disclosed that information.
Wow. That was what is that initial feeling like of just realizing that your phone You know, I think for me, even as an artist, you know, I think about my musical career, and you always dream of like, whoa, people knowing your name or knowing your voice and knowing your music. And what was that feeling like to realize like, whoa, every device has my voice on it?
Well, it was kind of horrifying, actually. And it took me a very long time to reveal myself, because I thought, because I love my voiceover career, and I've had an opportunity to do a lot of different, you know, things within the voiceover business. And I thought, oh boy, you know, if people find out this is me, that's it. I'm going to be Siri from now on. I'm going to not be able to do anything but Siri voice or computer voice and all this stuff. So I really wasn't sure how to approach it. And because it was such a unique situation, no one else knew what to do with it either, you know? And so eventually I listened to my husband and son, who were just pestering me the whole time, to go saying, this is such a unique opportunity. You really need to grab it. And finally I just decided, yeah, I guess I should. And so I jumped into the fray, but what I had suspected would happen did indeed happen. And of course, there are a lot of factors too. Somewhat is, you know, my age and the number of years that I've been in voiceover. So I end up doing a lot of messaging and narrations and that sort of thing. And I've appeared as lots and lots of computers.
Yeah, because as I talk to you now in this interview, your vocal tone is different as Siri. Like,
right.
How did you know how to like navigate and change your vocal tone?
Well, I didn't really. Although I'd have to say probably the fact that the original Siri voice was a little bit lower in my register, because I was working so hard. I was just reading, you know, for hours on end. And also, I think that the voice was manipulated to sound a certain way. I had read that one of the early engineers on the Siri project said they'd been looking for a voice that was otherworldly and had a very dry sense of humor. And so, you know, so they picked my voice, I guess. And yes, that I speak up here, but Siri was down there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was the original voice of Siri. And she was quite snarky, too. You had to be careful what you said to Siri, because no telling what she'd respond with.
That's so cool. Susan, you know, through my career, there are certain things, whether it's a podcast episode, whether it's a song or music video that I made, I watch it, but I watch it and I feel a different thing from watching it, because I think about where I was in my life at that time. Mm-hmm. It kind of symbolizes a timestamp or a moment, and it has a special meaning to me that the audience would never know because they weren't there.
Right.
What does Siri symbolize to you personally, like in your life, when you think of it or you hear it on the Apple device?
Oh, Well, you know, it's something that I had to learn to accept. I didn't like the idea at first. So therefore, it turned out to be an incredible life lesson. You know, I think that five things in life are very important: gratitude, love, acceptance, faith, and a sense of humor. And so I really had to hit that acceptance thing. And the amazing thing is that once you face your fear, or you face yourself worrying that you won't be able to do something well enough, or you're, oh, I'm not good enough to do that kind of thing. And once you can get over all those fears and all those objections that you have, you know, just personally, and make that leap of faith, and 9 times out of 10, the universe sort of, quote, has your back. And that's exactly what happened to me when I finally made the decision to reveal myself as the voice. Everything just opened up, and I did all kinds of interviews and, you know, radio and TV appearances and things like that. And then ultimately, thanks to Siri, I got a whole new career pretty late in my life, you know, doing speaker events and I did get to, I never met Steve Jobs. He actually died the day after Siri was introduced, which is a shame. I'm sorry that he didn't get to see what a phenomenon it turned out to be. But I did get to meet his partner, Steve Wozniak, or Woz. And he's the one that encouraged me to do the speaker events. He said, you're very comfortable on stage. He said, you really ought to look into this. So Yeah. So it's ended up being a good thing. I mean, the lesson for me is that, okay, you know, the old thing of, you know, making lemonade out of lemons. And that's just the way it is. You know, there are certain things you're not going to be able to change. And some things that you'll find in life, you'll have obstacles or you'll have something that really seems unfair. And it really bothers you. And the thing is that you really have to kind of think through it and figure out how it could possibly be a lesson or how it could possibly be a stepping stone to something more positive. But I just know that the people that get really hurt about something or really upset over something and they just can't let it go, the only person who suffers in that case is that person, you know, not the person that created the issue or, you know, created the scenario. It's the person that won't let it go that suffers.
I have two more questions for you. I've had the pleasure of interviewing people who, you know, when I asked them, like, yeah, you know, like about these amazing moments in their life.
Yeah.
They were just like, man, I was just doing my job and just like, you know, poof, it's like something happened.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get defined by that magical thing that you created. But how would you define Susan Bennett and who you are and your work?
Oh, dear. Well, I like to think that I'm flexible. I like to think that I'm open to doing different things and new things. And I really do. One of the reasons that I loved the voiceover business and also music as well is that every day was different. You know, every job was different. Every audience was different. And so that was a lot of fun for me to learn how to adapt to each different situation and, you know, try to make it a good situation.
And my closing question is, as I mentioned earlier, I got the chance of interviewing Bruce Wedeen, who's MJ's engineer. And this question was spawned from him because I was sitting in his home and interviewing him and looking at all the plaques on the walls and all the Grammys and all the pictures and all, like, it was like a museum.
Yeah.
Of just, whoa. And as I'm sitting there interviewing him, I realize that's a lot of sacrifice. Every Grammy symbolizes maybe a birthday that you missed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe it was that dinner with a friend that you couldn't go to, or that vacation you didn't go on because you were working and striving for greatness. And I realized that greatness comes with sacrifice. Susan, what have you had to sacrifice in your career to achieve the amazing things in life that you've achieved?
Well, I don't really think of myself as sacrificing much. During the years when I was traveling, when I was on tour, I have to thank my first husband very much. You know, thank you, Kurt, for helping raise our son. And fortunately, I wasn't gone for long, long, long periods of time. But in a way, that was kind of a sacrifice, you know, and, you know, motherhood is a guilt trip anyway. So when you're doing something like that, it's you feel doubly guilty. But I think that I really love the flexibility, learning to deal with a lot of different situations. And probably the most important thing for me personally was, as I said before, just being able to get through life utilizing the gifts that I was given, you know? And, you know, I mean, I'm not Lady Gaga, I'm not Beyonce, but I had a whole career of playing music and singing and, you know, have a great life. So, you know, I think sometimes people think that, well, if I can't be the pinnacle of stuff, then I shouldn't even try. Well, no, that's not true at all. You know, and especially if you're an artist in any kind of artistic endeavor, you know, just, you know, doing it is worth it. I saw a wonderful quote by, now I'm going to be able to see his face and not think of his name, Kurt Vonnegut, a famous author. And he talked about the fact that he learned something from professional musician. He was saying, well, you know, no, I don't, you know, I don't, I can sort of play the piano, but I, you know, I don't play because it's, you know, I'm not very good. And the guy says, well, that's just ridiculous. You need to play. If you could play, play. Because, you know, you just don't know what it's giving you. You know, it's giving you a lot, just being able to make any kind of music. So, you know, you have to be really careful. You know, I'm up for everybody going after their dream and stuff. But first of all, you kind of have to be realistic about it. You know, I mean, you're probably not going to be the next big runway model if you're 5'2". Okay. you know, there are certain limitations. And so I think it's really important to know yourself, know your own limitations, know the ones that maybe you can overcome, you know, and then, you know, life, as they say, life is short. So you don't want to waste it feeling bad. And just, you know, find the thing that you love, and it, whether you can make a living doing that or not, do it anyway on the side, you know, get some other job to pay the bills, and then, you know, do that. I think it's important for us to feed our souls, you know, in whatever way we can. And even if you're not an artistic person, I mean, you can appreciate art and you can appreciate music, and, you know, that's, and just make that part of your life. It's for me, that's something that always makes life better. I mean, I listen to music constantly.
That's right. One more question came in my mind.
Okay.
And I'll let you go. But what, when you hear your voice on the device, what do you hear?
Well, I hear myself. I recognize my voice, but I'm sort of disconnected from it. You know, I don't think of myself as Siri. You know, I think of myself as a voice actor who provided the voice for Siri. And so, you know, I sometimes find it, you know, quite amusing. You know, the first time I talked to Siri, you know, years and years and years ago, I said, "Well, hi, Siri, what are you doing?" And she very disgustedly said, "I'm talking to you." Okay.
That's so awesome. Susan, thank you so much for being a guest on the show on Silent Giants. And you know, I just want to leave you with this because, you know, it's such an honor to meet with you and, you know, leaving an impact on popular culture. You know, I think that I'm just really grateful to have the opportunity to speak with you and learn your story and learn who you are. And thank you for your contributions. You know, it honestly inspires people.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you because I've done a lot of interviews and I think you do a great job and you ask some great questions. So
thank you so much, Susan.
Kudos to you too.
Take care. All right.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of Silent Giants and to our special guest, Susan Bennett. Be sure to subscribe to Silent Giants on Apple and leave us a 5-star rating in the Apple app. And let me know what your favorite episode of Silent Giants has been thus far or who you think we should have on the show. Also, check out my other show, OPP with Corey Cambridge. OPP stands for Other People's Podcasts. It's a podcast where I interview America's top podcasters to learn more about them and the dope shows they created. You can find OPP with Corey Cambridge on Apple as well. This episode was mixed by Compost Media Flow. And lastly, before I get out of here, let me leave you with this. Always remember, creativity is intelligence. Having fun. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge, signing off. Till next time.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.